This morning, it's my pleasure to present Dr. Amar Desponde. Dr. Desponde is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology, University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. He completed his medical degree at University of Miami School of Medicine and stayed at University of Miami and Jackson Memorial Hospital for his internal medicine residency and gastroenterology fellowship. He does research at University of Miami Crohn's and Colitis Center. He's co-director of the Advanced IBD Fellowship and Vice Chair for Education, Division of Gastroenterology, Assistant Dean for Medical Education and Competency Assessment, and co-director of the Advanced Fellowship in Inflammatory Bowel Disease and Faculty Medical Director of the Department of Community Service. He's authored many articles, book chapters, and reviews in prestigious gastroenterology and internal medicine journals, with multiple presentations at national and international meetings, period. As someone practicing gastroenterology with a large percent of my practice in IBD and having some really challenging cases, he's been an excellent resource. And most challenging cases get discussed with Dr. Desponde over the phone, and oftentimes we send them down there to see him. This morning, Dr. Desponde's topic is celiac disease 2017, just the tip of the iceberg. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Desponde.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me back again this year. So I'll just get right into it. We'll talk about celiac disease in 2017. And so the first slide I'd like to really emphasize is what celiac isn't. I know we have an allergist in the room, so I don't want to like start a controversy on whether this is an allergy or not. But I'll just give you my two cents from the gastroenterologist perspective. So celiac disease has become such a common disease that's talked about in the lay press and lay literature that it's very uncommon to find. Everyone walks around saying, "Yeah, I think I feel better when I don't eat gluten, and I must have celiac disease." I want to emphasize that a lot of people feel better when they don't eat gluten, because if you actually pare down what they're actually avoiding, they're no longer eating 7 Snickers bars a day or a gallon of ice cream a day, and that's their less gluten. Being on a gluten-free diet generally means that someone's eating cleaner, healthier, and being more conscientious, and then they obviously will feel better because of that. So it doesn't necessarily mean they have this immunologically mediated disease known as celiac disease. So it's not IBS. There's a larger umbrella. I know a lot of people use IBS as a broad term for the gastroenterologists in the room, that we know that there's a broad term of functional GI disorders, of which IBS is one, and there's a criteria. People met in Rome and had this criteria about IBS. So there is some overlap, and I'll talk a little bit about the overlap between celiac and IBS. There are also a lot of non-immunologic food responses. So disaccharidase deficiencies, lactose intolerance is a very common thing. As we get older, we weren't intended to be breaking down milk later in our lives after breastfeeding. And so disaccharidase deficiency, like lactase deficiency, alcohol intolerance, food poisoning from things like Ciguatera. These are all non-immunologic food responses. It's not a wheat allergy. So for those of you that also practice in pediatrics, there is a wheat allergy. This is not an allergy to wheat, and I'll get into that. And one can argue it's not truly an allergy at all. It's not IgE mediated. There's no systemic role, really, of the allergic response, if you will, and it's not one of these rapid onset exposures to the allergen. So certainly one can have a discussion about whether this is even an allergy, and certainly it's not wheat allergy, which is a different entity. And then I was asked to touch a little bit on this newer term called non-celiac gluten sensitivity, which is probably what a lot of people have when they say they feel better when they avoid gluten. And so I'll talk about what that is, a relatively new term. And so why am I doing it? You heard that I do mostly inflammatory, or almost exclusively inflammatory bowel disease. I actually feel that celiac disease should be considered an inflammatory bowel disease. I'll show a few slides on the mucosal immunology of celiac disease. And for those of you that are also involved in the care of patients with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, you'll see that there's a large overlap between the mechanisms of the classic IBD you see in Crohn's with celiac disease. And to me, in my mind, it's much more an IBD than it is truly an allergy. The autoimmunity of it, the mucosal immunology of it, and also the role of the microbiome and the hygiene hypothesis with an increase in the prevalence of these autoimmune diseases over time in the past few decades. And so we'll talk about the history and epi of celiac disease and the pathophys. I'll try not to spend a lot of time with medical students and residents and fellows, and I sometimes maybe overdo the pathophys part. So I'll try to not focus too much on that. But I think it is important to understand the mechanism of the disease, to understand how we can potentially treat it, and then talk about current treatments and future therapeutic options, of which many are now being published for. We currently have no FDA-approved drugs for celiac disease, but a year from now that may well not be the case, and we may have them out. So in general terms, celiac disease is a condition of generally exclusively the small bowel, at least immunologically, in which susceptible individuals genetically, and we'll talk about what that genetic susceptibility is, develop this immune-mediated enteropathy or enteritis due to a sensitivity to, I say gluten, but really more broadly to things that are very proline and glutamine-rich. They're called prolamines, and I'll talk about what those are. That leads to an inappropriate assimilation of first micronutrients, particularly in the proximal bowel, so divalent cations, and eventually macronutrients like fats, proteins, and carbohydrates. And this is really a self-perpetuating disease. The more you have it and the more you don't treat it, the more malassimilation you have and the more malnutrition to which it can lead. So this was first described a couple thousand years ago, and the term comes from this original term. And then about 200 years ago, there were a group of patients that were having fat in their stool with weight loss and pallor, likely from iron deficiency anemia, that was felt to be some syndrome of diseases. And then about 150 years ago or so, a pediatrician had noted that there was probably a dietary component to this. And then later an American in the past 100 years noted that the patients with this disease did better when they ate fats than they did when they ate carbs. And so for a while, it was actually termed a Gee-Herder disease without much understanding of the background pathophysiology. And so interestingly, during World War II, when there was a big famine in the Netherlands, there was very little access to flour because of the war. And so one of these physicians noted that children that had this syndrome seemed to get better, correlating epidemiologically with less flour being available in diet. And so he felt that there was some association with flour. And then later, this was linked to gluten about 70 years ago, and we now know the value of using endoscopy to diagnose this. And so when we talk about incidence, this is one of the most common genetic diseases in Caucasians. So in our field of gastroenterology and hepatology, the two most common genetic diseases are hereditary hemochromatosis, which is very common in Caucasians, and celiac disease. And so we see an incidence in many European and studies of about 1 in 150 or so. Importantly, and many books will even say, you know, if they don't have Irish or Scandinavian or Northern European ancestry, they can't have celiac disease. And we know that is definitely not true now. We're seeing increased incidences in many parts of the world where we never historically have diagnosed celiac disease. And certainly part of that, we'll get to this hygiene hypothesis that I'll talk about shortly. But series from Africa, South America, Southeast and Far East Asia are now showing somewhat similar incidences in areas of the world that were thought to be less affected. And so the title that you saw was The Tip of the Iceberg. And so this is a reference to an article published now about 20 years ago in Lancet describing how little of celiac disease based on epidemiology is actually clinically apparent in the medical community. And so these are people who have symptoms, who have genetic predisposition, who have serologies that would be positive. And if you biopsied them, they would have abnormal mucosal and endoscopically and histologically. Then there's a group of people who have abnormal genetics, abnormal serologies, but have normal biopsies. Another large group of people that have abnormal genetics and serologies, and then a very large number of people who are genetically predisposed. So about a third of people in certain parts of Scandinavia, Northern Ireland are either DQ2 or DQ8 positive, and are in this very large group of people that will never develop celiac disease, but are potentially at risk for it. And so very little of celiac disease is actually, you know, above the water, clinically evident to people. And so when this was studied about now 10 years ago, I guess longer, almost 15 years ago, by a pediatric gastroenterologist at the University of Maryland, they took 13,000 patients, not patients, people who had given blood in the University of Maryland blood bank. And they went back and asked those people some risk factors, things like having symptoms like diarrhea, bloating, flatulence, and a family history of celiac disease. And they characterized people as either being at risk or not at risk for celiac disease. And then they took that blood that was given to the blood bank and they tested it for tissue transglutaminase, which is the most common serology check for celiac disease. And what you can see is that people that had symptoms had about a 1 in 40 chance, or 2.5% of those people actually had celiac disease that didn't know they had it. based on serologies. About one in five if they had first-degree relatives, and about one in 130, which goes along with the other epidemiologic studies, of people with no risk factors who were TTG positive, serologically positive for celiac disease. This was an overwhelmingly Caucasian population in this study, so maybe not as extrapolatable to the South Florida community with a much more diverse population. Nonetheless, suggesting that there's a lot of people that are not diagnosed with celiac disease. And so at the time, based on the population of America at the time, there was an estimate that there should be about 2 million people with the diagnosis code of celiac disease. And at the time, there was about 40,000, suggesting that for every patient that had celiac disease that we knew about, there were 50 of them out there that we didn't know about. And this presented an opportunity to really do a better job with diagnosing it. And unfortunately, in my mind, it's become such a popular term that everybody, as I said, who says that they avoid a gluten for a day and has more energy calls themselves a patient with celiac disease. It matters if it's celiac or not, because the implications in terms of morbidity and mortality are different. So this is actually a recent study from the Mayo Clinic earlier this year, where they looked at Olmsted County, which is where a lot of their epidemiologic studies are at Mayo. They looked at about 30,000 younger people under 50, and they had blood tests for tissue transglutaminase and endomysial. I'll talk about those a little later. None of these people were known to have celiac disease, and they found that the prevalence of undiagnosed celiac was, again, about 1 in 100. So these are people in the community just getting their blood tested, and about 1%, again, in a mostly white community in Minnesota, that had about a 1% prevalence of celiac disease. These are people that didn't know it and had no symptoms, so they really had no increased diarrhea, anemia, presumably bone mineral disease, and they had none of that. But they did have other autoimmune diseases like hypothyroidism, lower cholesterol suggesting nutrition, and a lower ferritin suggesting a lack of iron store or a decrease in iron stores. And the cumulative incidence of them subsequently developing celiac disease was about 11% compared to just 1 in 1,000, the seronegative people. So these are people that would then eventually develop symptoms of celiac disease. And so it's important that we're aware as both primary care physicians and gastroenterologists about this very common disease. So this could be a very long conversation. I'll try to limit this part the best I can, just a few minutes. But basically, in order to have celiac disease, you have to be genetically predisposed. And so there are a few exceptions. So this bottom point suggests that there are some non-HLA variants that affect immune function. But for the most part, I think for all intents and purposes, for all of us in this room, if you are DQ2, DQ8 negative, you cannot have celiac disease. So the negative predictive value of a genetic test is essentially 100%, that if you don't have the genetic predisposition that I'll show you in a second, that you can't develop celiac disease, at least the classic immune-mediated celiac disease. That's not to say that you don't feel better when you avoid gluten. It's to say that you don't have this specific immunologic disease known as celiac disease. And so the intolerance, and I try to avoid the term allergy because of the controversy as to whether this is an allergy or not, so I'll call it an intolerance. And intolerance is to gluten, which as someone who doesn't cook a lot, I had to like learn this, that the difference between starch and dough is when you wash one, the other one is the rest. And so the protein mass that's left after starch is washed away from dough, what that protein that's left, the protein of wheat, is known as gluten. But there's also the protein of barley and the protein of rye, and those are hordein and sequelin. And so these things all have in common, so it's not just gluten, it's gluten, hordein, and sequelin, are all polypeptides that represent the protein fractions of wheat, barley, and rye. And they are very rich in both proline and glutamine. And this is what we believe to be the reason that these people develop celiac disease, is because of these issues that we have with digesting this particular group of proteins. And so those with celiac disease are intolerant to wheat, barley, and rye. If you look at older textbooks, it'll say wheat, barley, rye, and oats. And I'll get into the oats in a second. That's probably not the case. And so the protein of oat, the polypeptide, when you wash away the starch from oats, is avenin. That shows no immune-mediated response, probably because it's less proline and glutamine rich. And so it's really these polypeptides that have a lot of prolines and glutamines in them that induce this effect. And similarly, the proteins of corn and rice, potato and soy, don't induce as much of an effect, probably because of less proline and glutamines. And so it's really the wheat, barley, and rye that's driving all of this immunologic response. And so what is the problem with prolines and glutamine? So none of us, whether we have celiac disease or not, humans don't have prolyl endopeptidase. And so if you recall how proteins are digested through pepsinogen and eventually some of these, and trypsin and a lot of these other peptidases and proteases that come from the pancreas, We have a lot of endopeptidases that will break down all of the 20 amino acids at various sites along that protein as we ingest protein. And we don't have, as humans, prolyl endopeptidase, so we're not able to cut at proline. That's not a big deal if you don't have a lot of prolines in that protein. But if you have a proline-rich protein, you're more likely to have larger segments of polypeptides that are not adequately digested as well as others. And so all of us don't digest proline-rich proteins very well. That's generally not a problem in nutrition because we have such a diverse array of amino acids and polypeptides that provide us cell structure. But in patients with celiac disease, they have these larger segments of polypeptides. When these then get through the epithelial tight junctions into the lamina propria, that's where the glutamine part comes in. If you have a genetic predisposition to celiac disease, then your antigen-presenting cells, your APCs, that are DQ2 or DQ8 positive, will latch onto these proline glutamine-rich polypeptides, and the glutamine will be deamidated by this enzyme that we all have, tissue transglutaminase, and then activate T cells to turn on an immune response to celiac disease. And so just to give you a brief summary of that, so here's there's two different pictures from two different issues of the New England Journal of Medicine where they give you really nice versions of this in one picture. Whether you look here at gliadin, which is essentially the prolamine here, or in this case, the prolamine here, you don't have prolyl endopeptidase, so these are larger polypeptides in all of us. And then let's skip for a second how they get through the tight junctions. Once they're in the lamina propria, this antigen-presenting cell, which is DQ2 or DQ8 positive, will then latch onto this gliadin, and then glutamine will be deaminated by TTG into this activated form of this APC. That'll then turn on the immune system initially with T cells and eventually B cells that will then make antibodies to everything around them, including making antibodies to the TTG that we all have. That's where they get TTG antibodies, including to the cell structure around it, which is the endomysium. And so they develop antibodies that are endomysial antibodies and tissue transglutaminase antibodies. And so that's the mechanism by which we check for these serologies, because they're developing a B cell response to the initial T cell immune mediated response that will cause these villi to get inflamed and not be able to assimilate as well. So the missing piece of that is then how do these proline glutamine rich polypeptides get through into lamina propria? Because I mentioned that a third of Northern Europeans are DQ2 positive, but only a small number of them ever develop celiac disease, mostly because their lamina propria never sees these polypeptides. So what is it about letting them sneak through these tight junctions? That's involving something called zonulin, which is also involved in the pathophysiology of diabetes. And when that's activated, and I'll skip the details, that will basically loosen up these tight junctions and let these polypeptides get through. And so getting celiac disease requires you to be DQ2 or DQ8 positive, not have prolyl endopeptidase, which is all of us, and then activate zonulin to open up these tight junctions to let this get through into lamina propria, where the immune-mediated reaction can occur. And so all these things have to occur in combination for someone to develop celiac disease. And this is just a more complicated picture of that, and I'll skip some of these. Just to say that resultant inflammatory cascade through mostly T cells and eventually B cells will lead to an enteritis or an inflammation of the small bowel. This will cause the villi to shorten and eventually to atrophy, which decreases surface area of absorption, thereby decreasing assimilation of micronutrients and subsequently macronutrients. Classically, it's the proximal small bowel that's involved. So a lot of these divalent cations and trivalent cations like iron, folate, calcium, magnesium, zinc, because of calcium in part, as well vitamin D. Less so the things that are absorbed distally in the ileum. So things like B12 and vitamin K deficiency are less common in this type of celiac disease. Tropical sprue, which is a completely different disease, can involve the ileum and involves fat-soluble vitamin malassimilation, and then eventually macronutrient malassimilation as well. So, as I mentioned, about a third of white Northern Europeans are DQ2 positive. Why is it only 1% of these people eventually develop celiac disease? So I mentioned the issue with zonulin, which refers to this chemokine receptor here. And we also don't know when it is that you need to avoid or not avoid. So many women with young children will ask, I have celiac disease, what should I do for my child? When can I wean them off of breast milk and expose them to cereals, to food, to minimize the chances of getting celiac disease? And I'll touch on that in a second. When you look at the world and the prevalence of celiac disease, what you'll see is the highest prevalences are in areas that are generally developed or are actively developing industrially, economically, which generally correlates with better sanitation and better hygiene. And so I guess something got, there's a part here that got lost, but the microbiome and hygiene piece is important because as we have a much more hygienic culture where we're born by C-section and put socks on when you're 1 second old and put in an incubator and not allowed to play in the dirt and not allowed to eat anything off the floor and wash our hands 75 times a day, which is important for C. diff, but bad for celiac disease. We end up living in a very sterile environment. This is true for celiac disease. It's true for inflammatory bowel disease as well, where that first enteric infection of rotavirus or whatever it is or salmonella when you're 1 or 2 or 3 years old will lead to an aberrantly overzealous immune response, and if you have the right genetic predisposition, you can't downregulate it, and then you get these chronic autoimmune diseases. And so I'm sure it's been shown before, the New England slide from 15 years ago, that as we've seen a marked decrease in a lot of infectious diseases like rheumatic fever and tuberculosis and influenza, we've seen a rapid increase in a lot of autoimmune diseases, lupus, asthma, multiple sclerosis, celiac disease, and these are probably related. And then the other piece that is part is missing from the slide in this view is even things like method of delivery. So they've looked in Scandinavia, where they have access to great, like really huge case control and cohort studies, looking at if you were born by C-section, you're much more likely to develop celiac disease than if you were born by vaginal delivery. And then when they break down C-section into urgent C-section, which the membrane's ruptured, versus elective C-section, it's really the elective C-section people that are at highest risk for autoimmune diseases because they never were exposed to their mother's vaginal or bacterial flora, and their microbiome is different early in life, which may set off an immune cascade subsequent that manifests itself when they're 10, 12, 15, 20 years old. And so even things like method of delivery do affect the likelihood of developing some of these diseases. That's not to say that we're at the point in medicine where you should advise a woman to get a vaginal versus a C-section delivery based on this data alone. But certainly there are data that those who are born by C-section do have an increased likelihood of developing certain autoimmune diseases. And so when I talk about, so then the big question becomes, when do you tell parents about when it's okay to expose their children to gluten? And so I'm going to skip, for the sake of time, a few of these slides. There's a lot of data on here that's probably more than you want to know. These are two New England articles back-to-back in 2014. Forget all the data. Basically, there were two back-to-back studies, both showing we have no idea when to start gluten. They tried 3 months, they tried 6 months, they tried 9 months, they tried 12 months. This was a big study in the Pediatrics Journal called the TEDDY study. They tried less than 17 versus more than 26 weeks about when you introduce gluten into the diet. We know it has to be important. I mean, mechanistically and epidemiologically, it has to be important, but there's every study that's done just muddies the water a little further. This was another study showing that maybe it was the first 2 years of life, maybe it wasn't. And then this is a position paper by the European PDGI Society, which puts out some of the best work in celiac disease because they have such a high prevalence in Europe of celiac disease. And there's a few things that I highlighted here. Neither any breastfeeding nor breastfeeding during gluten introduction has been shown to reduce the risk. Anytime between 4 and 12 months, the bottom line is we're not really sure yet. And the more studies you read, the more confused you'll get about how you should advise your patients on when you should advise the mothers to introduce gluten, because we just don't really know yet. This data is very conflicting. It certainly seems like it should be important about when you activate the immune system, but every study that's done has been slightly different in terms of its results. So we don't have any great recommendations, unfortunately, at this point. So that was what I wanted to cover about the background of why celiac disease occurs, and then we'll get on to how these present, which I think is much more relevant for the clinicians in the room. So in children, it's not as always as obvious because they're not as able to voice their HPI as well as adults can, but certainly diarrhea, stunted growth is a big one. So for the pediatricians that see people falling off the growth chart or diagnose failure to thrive, this is one of the first things, in addition to inflammatory bowel disease, celiac disease is a big thing that they think about, as well as an inappropriate anemia relative to that patient, that kid's age. In adults, which is I think for most of us in this room, diarrhea, excessive flatulence, either with flatus or eructation or burping, iron deficiency anemia, weight loss. This thing that patients describe as lactose intolerance. Remember that the disaccharidases, lactase, maltase, sucrase, are brush border enzymes. They live on the brush border of the duodenum. So as you inflame the duodenum from celiac disease, you will lose your brush border enzymes. So you will develop, by definition, a secondary lactase deficiency. And so they will notice that they have a problem with dairy and milk. It's not because they have a true primary issue with lactase production, which is the reason for many people's lactase deficiencies, but rather this is a secondary lactose intolerance because they have inflammation of their proximal small bowel, fatigue, not feeling well, abdominal cramping. And so if you look at this, a young woman, let's say, with a little bit of diarrhea and cramping and lack of energy, many people will diagnose that woman with irritable bowel syndrome, and you'll usually be correct epidemiologically in terms of that diagnosis. But they looked back at a set of patients with IBS and or fibromyalgia, and they did, again, tissue transglutaminase antibody testing on them. And 5-7% of them, which was fivefold greater than the general population, had celiac disease. And the reason this is important is for those of you that have ever tried to have a conversation about IBS with a patient and they're like, what should I do? It's a staring competition, basically, because you give them a bunch of recommendations that may or may not work, and we try to be intellectual about it, about a low FODMAP diet and IB guard and peppermint and whatever stuff you want to offer that person. And for IBS-D, we do have a couple of drugs that are now FDA approved, as well as for IBS-C. But for the most part, it's a frustrating conversation because you feel very helpless that patient is not well and you're not doing as much as you'd like to do to help him or her. And this is important because if 5% of those people have a very distinct abnormality and a very specific diet will actually completely reverse their symptoms, then it certainly is a very meaningful thing for them. And so before we just throw out the diagnosis of IBS, which is, by the way, going to be right 95% of the time, at least 1 in 20 of those patients would benefit from this diagnosis and having a much more targeted therapy approach. And there's also a bunch of extra-intestinal manifestations, many of which are autoimmune in nature. And so to that point, there are a couple of studies, one showing that about 20% of patients with celiac disease have another autoimmune disease, and in the pediatric literature, about 15% of them have autoimmune liver disease as well. And so there are a lot of different things that can occur along with celiac disease, so bone mineral issues, so osteopenia, premature osteoporosis, liver disease with elevated aminotransferases. For the neurologist, if they have an unusual polyneuropathy, part of the differential is celiac disease, and sometimes the first diagnosis is by a neurologist who checks a TTG antibody in a patient with celiac disease. For the reproductive endocrinologist in the room, I don't presume there are any, but if there hypothetically were, then when people have recurrent miscarriages, recurrent abortions, or infertility, part of this infertility workup also involves checking antibodies for celiac disease. And then a lot of associated conditions, I highlighted or bullet pointed a few, with a recurring theme of autoimmunity. So primary biliary, it's not called primary biliary cholangitis, PBC is autoimmune, autoimmune hepatitis is obviously immune, Down syndrome, there's a strong association, autoimmune thyroid disease, classically autoimmune hypothyroidism or Hashimoto's, autoimmune diabetes, dermatitis herpetiformis is a skin manifestation that we'll talk about shortly, and I'll also touch on selective IgA deficiency. So this is dermatitis herpetiformis. It is not herpes. If you stain for herpes, the stain will be negative, but it's herpetiform because it has these vesicular blistering lesions that crust over, similar to herpetic lesions. If you biopsy them, they'll stain positive for IgA, and these are generally treated by avoidance of gluten, the same way celiac disease is treated. Sometimes they'll use Dapsone, they're dermatologists, but it'll generally respond to a gluten-free diet. And so this is the classic skin manifestation of celiac disease. So how do we diagnose celiac disease? So the gold standard is still duodenal biopsy. So doing an upper endoscopy and taking biopsies in the proximal small bowel is the gold standard, although the serologies are getting better and better and better. And so in 2017, these serologies are in the low to mid 90s sensitivity and specificity. So these will hopefully eventually supplant endoscopy as we get better and better with these, but currently the gold standard still is an endoscopy. So if someone has typical symptoms, I mean, this you can make a similar analogy to stress test versus cath in someone who has chest pain. If you have a high degree of suspicion, just go straight to the gold standard. So if someone has typical symptoms, go straight to an upper endoscopy or an EGD. And then if you need to confirm why they have villus blunting, because other things, so for example, a common variable immunodeficiency can look histologically similar to celiac disease. It'll have no plasma cells, so it'll be a difference in how it looks to the trained pathologist, but they can look similar. Giardia can have villus blunting, and that's not celiac disease. And so Doing an upper endoscopy first, then confirming with serologies is the reasonable approach in someone in whom you have a high pretest probability. And in a more moderate pretest probability is where you go for the less invasive non-gold standard. In this case, doing serologies for celiac disease, and if they're positive, certainly confirming that with duodenal biopsies. So I mentioned that you essentially have to have DQ2 or DQ8 positivity to have celiac disease, so why not check genetics? So they're a great test for their negative predictive value, but they're a terrible test for people that you think may have the disease because, as I mentioned, if a third of people in Northern Europe are DQ2 positive and only 1% of those people actually have celiac disease, then you're going to cause a lot of undue concern in the patient and yourself and not know how to deal with that positive result. And so the only real value in genetic testing is if you're pretty sure they don't have it and you've been confused by the diagnosis, they've been confused, they've been told five things by five different people, and you kind of want to settle it, as long as you study ahead of time, if it's positive, nothing changes in our conversation. But if it's negative, at least we can get rid of that diagnosis. This is not going to be celiac disease, and we can look for other reasons for whatever constellation of symptoms or signs you have. And so that's really the value of this, is in its negative predictive value that approaches 100%. But serologies are the best test in the primary care setting because you have access to easy, cheap blood tests. This is a little old, but we usually use tissue transglutaminase. We have avoided gliadin antibodies. You see these numbers aren't as impressive for sensitivity and specificity in the past, but there are now deamidated gliadin antibodies. So I mentioned that deamidation is what happens with TTG deamidating glutamine. And so there are now deamidated gliadin antibodies that are much more sensitive and specific that approach that of TTG and endomysial. And so now we have several serologies that are in the mid to high, or mid-90s, I should say, sensitivity and specificity. I mentioned something about IgA deficiency earlier. This becomes relevant not so much for the pathophysiology of the disease, but in the diagnosis. And so selective IgA deficiency is actually a pretty common thing that a lot of people don't even know they have. It's about 1 in 400 in the general population. But in celiac disease, there's a tenfold increase in prevalence of IgA deficiency. And so about 2.5% of people with celiac disease are IgA deficient. Again, that's not so important for the celiac disease itself, but if all the tests you're doing to check for it are IgA antibody tests, then you can get a false negative test if they are IgA deficient. So my personal practice, though not mandated by guidelines, is to check a serum IgA along with the TTG IgA, because if the TTG IgA is negative in the setting of a low serum IgA, that may be a false negative test, and you reflex to an IgG TTG, which you don't do as a first test because it's not quite as good. The IgGs are not quite as good as the IgAs, but you need to do that if they have selective IgA deficiency. And so that's the importance of IgA deficiency. So another important piece is that now there are groups of labs that will give you these really attractive offers of like panel testing for celiac disease. So if there are any oncologists in the room, panel testing, obviously genetic testing, panel testing in GI, oncology, many other fields is becoming really popular. But the downside to that is always getting more information than you want to know and information that potentially is harmful, at least in your diagnostic capabilities. And so there are panel tests to check for TTG IgA, TTG IgG, endomysial IgA, endomysial IgG, gliadin IgA, gliadin IgG. You're getting six antibodies. If all of them have a sensitivity of 93% and a specificity of 95%, and one of them and your panel test comes back with one of those six being positive, the positive one's probably the wrong one, and the five that are negative are probably the right one. But when someone sees a paper that says celiac disease positive, it's really, or any disease positive, it's really hard to get that out of, it's really hard to tease out what that means. And so you end up frustrating yourself and the patients by ordering five antibodies at once. So another reason cost limitations is certainly an important reason as well, but even intellectually, in adults, just pick one. They're all good, so you can check a gliadin, you can check a TTG, you can check an endomysial. The only exception, for those of you that may be med-peds, is in the very young patients, like those under the age of two, because they don't have as developed of an immune system, there is an argument to check maybe a couple of them, because one of them may be a false negative. But in adults, unless you have a reason to believe that they are profoundly immune deficient, and even then, I would probably just check just one antibody. TTG, endomysial, deaminated gliadin are all good these days. There is an entity of antibody-negative celiac disease that I won't touch on for the purpose of this talk, but we do know that the higher your titer is to TTG, the more antibodies you are making to TTG, the more active your celiac disease is. That correlates to a lower bone mineral density, probably from malassimilation of calcium and vitamin D, a lower hemoglobin, probably from a malassimilation of iron, a lower BMI from malnutrition, a lower cholesterol from malnutrition, as well as its association with diabetes. So what about biopsies? And so the gold standard, despite those excellent serologies, is still doing small bowel biopsies. We know that it affects mostly the proximal rather than the distal small bowel. And so we prefer an EGD or an esophagogastroduodenoscopy or upper endoscopy as the best modality to acquire tissue. Sometimes you have to go a little further, but for the most part, I think for the purpose of this talk, taking duodenal biopsies is adequate. This is a picture of what a normal small bowel looks like. You see these normal folds of what likely is the second or third portion of the duodenum. And then here, you see that it's maybe hard to see in the distance, but these look a little scalloped. Here again, on close-up view, this looks like these ridges. And then this is called chromoendoscopy. You can spray this blue dye on the intestinal wall to see better. There's a lot of kind of scalloping of the small bowel folds. This is what you see in very endoscopically apparent celiac disease. But importantly, this doesn't happen until pretty late in the disease. And so as the gastroenterologist, if you see a completely normal small bowel, it is not enough to say the small bowel looks normal, you don't have celiac disease. You have to take biopsies. And that's for this reason. So this is a normal small bowel biopsy on the left. And the basic takeaway, the three things that I want to emphasize are that you have a normal number of lymphocytes in the epithelium. You have a ratio of the height of the villus about three or four times the height of the crypts, and you have normal appearing heights of the villi. So in celiac disease, the first thing to happen is you develop an intraepithelial lymphocytosis. So you get a lot of lymphocytes in the epithelium. Then you'll get a hypertrophy of the crypts. The stem cells are trying to make more enterocytes, and so the crypts get larger as the villi get smaller. So normally this is 3:5:1 ratio of the height of the villus to the height of the crypt becomes more 1:1. And here you see a big crypt versus a very small or completely flattened villus. And then finally you get complete villus blunting. And so the specifics of this aren't important other than to say that early celiac disease, so this is a Marsh classification, is intraepithelial lymphocytosis. Then you get crypt hyperplasia. Then you get villus blunting and atrophy, and then eventually total atrophy from Marsh 1 to Marsh 4. And importantly, you're not going to see it endoscopically until it's somewhere around here. You're not going to see it endoscopically when it's somewhere around here. And that's why we have an obligation to not just look, but also take biopsies and allow our pathologists to help us tell us that there is either intraepithelial lymphocytosis or hyperplastic crypts with a normalization of the or a equalization of the villus to crypt ratio, and eventually, in more obvious cases, villus atrophy. So I'll skip this, other than to say that we need to take at least 4 or 5 biopsies because of the patchiness of the disease. Importantly, just because you have villus blunting, it doesn't make it celiac disease. I mentioned CVID, which is common variable immunodeficiency, HIV enteropathy, Giardia, Whipple disease is an infectious disease, lymphangiectasia, tropical sprue, Crohn's disease, this is the gastrinoma, Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, bacterial overgrowth, food allergies. Many of these things can lead to villus atrophy, and so it's important then to get the serologies to confirm that. Most of those don't also have the lymphocytes in the epithelium, so that's usually a helpful sign that this is probably celiac disease. And then sometimes if they're negative on biopsies, we can do things like capsule endoscopy. Here's a picture of a capsule endoscopy in the mid-small bowel in which you can clearly see this abnormal scalloping of the mucosa of the small bowel that is consistent with celiac disease. So what about this new term? So this term was non-existent 5 years ago, and now it's in the literature with an increasing degree of prevalence. NCGS is non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So I'll take you a few steps back and say they've done studies where people that are DQ2, DQ8 negative, so functionally cannot have celiac disease, have been given gluten-free diets, and many of the and even in randomized sham controlled trials, where they didn't know what they had, and gluten avoidance makes people's digestive scores of symptoms improve. And if you avoid gluten by proxy, you are avoiding things like these fermentable oligodiamonosaccharides, which are the things that cause bloating and discomfort. You're probably eating things with fewer preservatives. These cleaner, healthier diets that are becoming more popular now. And so that's really likely what this effect is. And so we know that these people are better with gluten avoidance, but they don't have genetically celiac disease. And so this was a recent editorial in the British Medical Journal by a well-known celiac researcher. I don't know how he calculated this, what the most common, the most popular diet ever is, but and Arthur Agatston on Miami Beach may disagree, saying South Beach is the most popular diet ever. But it's one of the most popular diets in the history of recording of diets. But is it? And the reason I mention this is because we can say, why doesn't the whole country just get rid of gluten everywhere? There are, well, first of all, it would be a lot less fun to eat. But equally importantly, there are potentially downsides to going so overboard with avoiding all gluten. So perhaps more atherosclerotic deposition. These are just epidemiologic studies. There's no kind of great biological plausibility to these. And importantly, maybe some imbalance of trace metals that we don't normally measure, things like selenium and chromium, that maybe as you avoid a lot of things in your diet may lead to issues downstream. These are just potential downsides to avoiding gluten when you don't really need to. Certainly, I would say to people, if you feel a ton better when you avoid certain foods, then by all means, avoid those foods. So in whom do we screen patients? So not necessarily people that have celiac disease, but people in whom we're trying to screen them ahead of time. So if you have concomitant autoimmune disease, particularly autoimmune hypothyroidism or autoimmune diabetes, type 1 diabetes, it's certainly reasonable to screen them for celiac disease, even with minimal or no symptoms. First degree relatives of those with celiac disease. Unexplained iron deficiency, I guess, is not really screening because now they have people with issues. But iron deficiency anemia is abnormal in any man. It's abnormal in any postmenopausal woman. And it's abnormal, this is a more gray area, in any menstruating woman in whom you feel the IDA is disproportionate to her degree of menses. And that's not necessarily a black and white issue. But anyone with unexplained iron deficiency warrants an evaluation or consideration of malassimilation of iron in the proximal duodenum, which is most commonly caused by celiac disease. Certainly looking for things like colon cancer and ulcer disease are also important, but this should absolutely be part of the workup. And if you're referring someone for an endoscopic evaluation for iron deficiency anemia, the gastroenterologist has the obligation to not just do the colonoscopy, but ideally get into the ileum and then do an endoscopy and take biopsies in the duodenum. If they're going to do the endoscopy anyway, they should certainly take duodenal biopsies to rule out this process if they don't find any other reason for that iron deficiency anemia. The endocrinologists are more and more sending us patients where they diagnose the celiac disease on the basis of a 38-year-old or 40-year-old woman who is not yet postmenopausal, who shouldn't have osteoporosis yet, who's broken three bones and has a low bone mineral density, and any of those high-risk groups from that previous slide that are at increased risk. Importantly, the USPSTF is ramping up there a lot of in the past several months. The USPSTF has come out with several recommendations about things like sleep apnea and other things. They came out with their recommendations in March 2017 about just screening the general population. And so this is relevant, for example, in Scandinavia, where everybody gets TTG testing because of the prevalence of the disease. Based on the data and literature that's available to us today in 2017 in the U.S., the USPSTF came out with the recommendation that we shouldn't just generally screen the general population. So this is screening, not people that are symptomatic. But certainly those that are symptomatic should be considered for serologic testing. So now we'll go on to treatment. And so the hallmark of treatment, so we know that if you present a patient with celiac disease, wheat, barley, or rye, so gluten, sclerin, or hordene, that's going to incur this immune-mediated reaction in the genetically susceptible patient that leads to celiac disease. So if you avoid those things, you will, by definition, not have active celiac disease, and you will heal the lining of your small bowel, and you will have none of the issues that put you at risk of complications of celiac disease. And so the hallmark of the treatment is removal of all these damage-inducing prolamines, so wheat, barley, and rye. And so in 2004, so we're really behind the eight ball here, and so as recently as 15 years ago, there was really nothing that would protect consumers. And then about 13 years ago, the FDA passed this act that required manufacturers to clearly state these major food allergens. So these are things that you see in things like eosinophilic esophagitis and other allergic diseases that everyone has to mention: milk, eggs, peanuts, tree nuts, fish, shellfish, wheat, and soy. But this was not specific to gluten, and it did make somewhat more stringent guidelines what constitutes gluten-free, but it was still kind of loosey-goosey. And then in 2013, which is only 4 years ago, is when the FDA mandated that you can only call yourself gluten-free, which is like that whole aisle in Publix and Winn-Dixie of gluten-free stuff, if you have less than 20 parts per million of gluten in your product. And so this was the first time that they really allowed consumers to have confidence that when they bought something at the store, that when they say gluten-free, it truly is gluten-free. There are people that have symptoms even with lower concentrations than this, but 20 parts per million is the current standard, above which you cannot call yourself gluten-free in the food manufacturing industry. It's a little more challenging in the restaurant industry, where there's less regulation about whether you put a G next to the little, you know, like whatever the dish is, and they can put a G next to it saying it's gluten-free. There's less regulation to that, but certainly there is in the manufacturing industry. So once you avoid gluten, wheat, barley, and rye, and this is, I found on the internet, this is an old British slide saying I have an allergy to gluten, and it says barley, rye, wheat, and oats. And so importantly, I may have brushed over it, the reason that oats aren't part of our avoidance and diet anymore is because they don't have as much of that immunologic effect. And the reason that older studies probably involved oats is because in those days you could mill all the grains together. And now that we're separating, and these manufacturers have to separate the milling of oats from the milling of wheat, barley, and rye, and oats are purely just oats and not contaminated with wheat, barley, and rye, they're able to tolerate them okay. So oats are no longer part of what we routinely say patients need to avoid. As you avoid these things that are causing problems, the wheat, barley, and rye, they should get better within days to weeks. It may take months for the serologies to normalize, and it's only relevant if their pre-diet serology, that's gluten-free diet, was positive. Some people are antibody negative. But it's a nice way of monitoring both improvement and adherence. So if someone's TTGIGA was 100, and now it's 3 months later, and they're a little better, but their serologies are negative, you at least know you've addressed the celiac part of it. Maybe you have to look for other reasons for their symptoms. Conversely, if their TTG serologies were 100 and now they're still 98 and they're convinced they're avoiding gluten, then you have to do a much better dietary history, probably with the help of a nutritionist or a dietitian, to figure out what they're consuming that they're not realizing has gluten in it that is causing them to not get better. And then it takes months, sometimes up to a year, for histology to improve, meaning that your biopsies will turn to normal and your endoscopy will appear normal. So this is from the NIH, and so this is an acronym, celiac. Really important in celiac disease is to give them access, unless you feel you have the time to spend a lot of time in a clinic with your patient discussing these. A lot of people live in a world where they have to see everybody in 10 or 15 minutes and go on to the next patient, so it can be really challenging. So you can, I mean, certainly doctors are capable of providing these guidelines, but dietitians are really good at this and oftentimes can spend more time with the patients. And so this is a little acronym for things to consider as you treat people with celiac disease. So consult with a skilled registered dietitian who can talk to them about what it means to avoid gluten, educate them about what it is, adherence to the lifelong adherence to a gluten-free diet, even when they feel well. I'll get to that in a second. Treating deficiencies, support groups, because there's people have a really difficult time oftentimes finding diets that they like, and then multidisciplinary support long term. So what if they don't respond to this gluten-free diet? So the most common reason to not respond is it's tough. There are people who say, listen, I'm going to a birthday party tomorrow and I want to have a slice of pizza, and I'm willing to deal with the repercussions 2 days later, for the next 2 days after that. Intentional non-compliance, because it's a very difficult diet. There's also inadvertent non-adherence. So for example, there's hordein in beer. So thank God I don't have celiac disease, because that would be the end for me. But so there now are gluten-free beers, so you can actually purchase gluten-free beers in various bars. There's gliadin in the preservatives of a lot of medications. So you have to, some of these patients have to call every medicine they take, they have to call the company to see there's no gluten in the capsule, though now they're much better about avoiding it. There's the sticky part of envelopes that you lick, used to have gluten in them, so that's a Seinfeld reference for why I think Costanza's wife died. You have to be kind of aware of a lot of these things. Importantly, people ask about shampoos and cosmetics and lipstick and eye and cheek, whatever those things are called that you put on your face, makeup. Importantly, you have to consume it. So if it's shampoo or soap or the eye thing that you put on your eyes, lipstick may be an issue if you're licking your lips a lot, but unless you're like drinking the shampoo or drinking the soap water, it's not really an issue. You have to consume it to allow it to be exposed to the small bowel to then exert its effect. And so if there's gluten in the shampoos or the conditioners or the moisturizers, that should be okay as long as you're avoiding consumption. There are some complications of celiac disease that if someone is adherent to the diet, they've normalized their serologies, and now they still have diarrhea, they may have developed something called microscopic colitis, where we have to do a colonoscopy and biopsy for lymphocytes in the colon. And again, a gluten-free diet usually helps that, as do things like topical steroids, like a drug that's called budesonide or Uceris. And they can sometimes get these bad diseases like ulcerative duodenitis and a really bad type of T-cell lymphoma called enteropathy-associated T-cell lymphoma. This is an example of ulcers in the jejunum that can occur with celiac disease. And so when they don't respond to the diet, you think of other things they could concurrently have with similar demographics. They could maybe have dysmotility and bacterial overgrowth. And importantly, this enteropathy-associated T-cell lymphoma, they could also have an increased risk of non-Hodgkin's, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, squamous cell cancer of the esophagus, small bowel adenocarcinoma are also increased prevalence in celiac disease. Very few of these patients truly have what we call refractory SPRU. This is a very small group of patients that, again, immunologically are developing a clonal expansion of aberrant of lymphocytes in the epithelium. Those are the ones that eventually can develop lymphoma. There's two types. We don't have to get into which one's which. They can respond to things that we use for things like inflammatory bowel disease, like strong immunosuppressives, and there's even case reports of doing stem cell transplantation. But this is the point is that most people who say I'm not better with my diet, it's rarely this. It's usually, let's do a better job of figuring out what you're missing in the diet that we're not catching that has gluten in it, much more so in this very uncommon disease that's mostly in the realm of gastroenterologists and celiac centers. So how are we doing? You know, we talked about 1 in 50 patients are underdiagnosed. So the CORI database is a database that many gastroenterologists submit their endoscopic findings to. So there's hundreds of thousands of endoscopy reports in this database that's held at the University at Oregon's Health Sciences Center. So they looked back at people that were already undergoing endoscopies. This is not about, should I subject my patient to an endoscopy? These patients were already undergoing an upper endoscopy because their primary doctor, their gastroenterologist, whomever wanted it. And the indications were anemia, iron deficiency, weight loss, diarrhea. In those four indications, you can make the argument about should I do an endoscopy or not. But if you're going to do the endoscopy anyway, there should be little argument on taking the biopsies. And yet, in 2004, these are the numbers of people by gastroenterologists who are the our group are the experts in this disease, in which less than 20% of patients with those indications were getting biopsied. And so, you know, we have to put it on ourselves in GI that I'm not saying that everyone with a little bit of anemia needs an upper endoscopy. What I am saying that is if you're doing it for iron deficiency and you're already doing the endoscopy and you're in the duodenum, you have an obligation to take the biopsies. And so we're really underdiagnosing this common disease. And so what are some future therapies? So I mentioned that one of the ways in which people that are genetically predisposed to celiac disease get activated is because zonulin will allow these tight junctions to open up and you'll get an influx of these prolamine glutamine-rich polypeptides into lamina propria that then get activated, that activate the immune system. So there is a zonulin inhibitor called lorazepam, which had some decent data. You know, there's currently, as I said, no FDA-approved therapies for celiac disease, and so this is one that was studied. There's also these things that antagonize chemokine trafficking that don't let, again, zonulin get activated. We said that humans don't have prolyl endopeptidase. What if we give patients prolyl endopeptidase, like we give patients lactase? That helped with a little bit of less fat in the stool, but not overall therapy. So perhaps maybe someone can say, I'm going to have pizza tomorrow, so let me take some of this so I don't feel as bad when I take it as an on-demand thing. I'll skip the immunotherapy for a second. But this is an example. This was published this year in our major GI journal, an oral combination of two recombinant proteases that target gluten specifically, so-called glutenases. So this is latiglutenase and placebo. And you see here, unfortunately, that this turned out to be a negative study. This is a phase 2 study. Basically, it had both symptoms and histologic evidence of celiac disease. It did not improve histologic or symptom scores compared to placebo. However, a post hoc analysis found, this was just published electronically recently, that in those who were seropositive, who maintained TTG positivity even after getting the diet, those patients seem to do well with this drug. So maybe there is a market for the patients who are still positive in their serologies, even after they are purportedly avoiding gluten. And there's also a study that I won't get into the Brazil talk about, maybe a vaccine that makes this, it's peptide immunotherapy. You see there's a lot of things that are being studied, and this is a few years old, but a lot of these overlap with lymphoma therapies, with IBD therapy, with inflammatory bowel disease therapies, with a lot of with psoriasis therapies, with RA therapies, monoclonal antibodies against various parts of the immune system that get overactivated with celiac disease. So I'll close just with a couple of comments. So besides quality of life, so we know that celiac patients will get, if they eat something with gluten in it, will get diarrhea, they'll get bloating, they'll be uncomfortable, maybe they'll have a little bit of a low iron. But does it really, that's quality of life, that's up to them. Like if they want to deal with that, those symptoms, and by all means eat the gluten if you're willing to deal with the symptoms. So besides quality of life, do we actually care? So this is a very interesting, I kind of combined two studies into one slide. There's a study that looked at 9,000 healthy adults, blood from 9,000 healthy people from the Air Force during the Korean War. And they had stored blood samples from 60 years ago from these healthy Air Force pilots, and they tested those 60-year-old blood samples for TTG, and the serology testing was 0.2% of them, or 1 in 500, were TTG positive. They then took a matched cohort of people in the Air Force today with no GI symptoms that are healthy, and they had a prevalence of about 0.8% of celiac disease. So you're getting rid of the recognition bias that they didn't know about in the 50s. You're taking blood from the 50s and blood from the 2010s, and in 60 years, there's been a fourfold increase in a relatively similar group of people, these people that are healthy people in the Air Force. And so the first point I want to make is there seems to be, irrespective of recognition bias, there seems to be an increase of 4 to 5-fold of prevalence and incidence of this disease over the past several decades. Part of that may be this hygiene hypothesis. And then when they looked at the people of those 9,000 healthy adults in the Air Force base, and they looked at those that were positive versus negative for celiac disease, and followed how long they lived over the next 50 years, there was a fourfold risk of death if you were TTG positive versus TTG negative. This is not to imply that celiac disease is killing people everywhere. It should show you, to a statistically significant degree, that there is an association, maybe not a causation, but an association that those who were positive for celiac serologies had a lower survival curve than those who were negative for celiac serologies. And could they all have been in the same battle, in the same war? Maybe. But this suggests that there may be a mortality issue as well. And this was confirmed by this large Swedish database. You will never get these numbers in an American study because we don't have access to that. We have such a fragmented healthcare system. But they had 45,000 celiac patients with a 5-to-1 controls to cases. And they did find that that there was an increased all-cause mortality in patients with celiac disease. The caveat is this is such a highly powered study that an individual person's risk of death is exceedingly small. They're much more likely to die of cardiovascular disease or malignancies unrelated to celiac disease. But it is to suggest that even if you feel well, you should still avoid the gluten, because gluten is causing this, if you have celiac disease, because you have a continuous autoimmune attack on your small bowel, which can lead to long-term complications that include things like malignancy. And we do know that for the increased risk of large diffuse B-cell lymphoma, the patients that are most likely to get that are the patients that a year later still have a lot of atrophy in their villi. And if you can normalize that, so for those of you in the room that treat Crohn's disease, for example, we now know that after they feel well, we want to rescope them to make sure that they have healed mucosa. Similarly, if you can show mucosal healing, you significantly decrease the risk of a lot of these complications long term. So for those of you interested, I think this is really a nice review for primary care and non-gastroenterologists. This is from JAMA just like a month or two ago. And so it's a review of celiac disease and non-celiac gluten sensitivity. It's a nice review that you can look at. And I'll just close with saying there's a lot of really nice resources. So though this may seem debilitating to patients that they can't eat things they enjoy anymore, there are amazing cookbooks now of pastas and all different types of foods and drinks that taste like the real deal, but without gluten. So there are a lot of opportunities for them to lead a completely normal life. And some of these are websites that help with some of those cookbooks for different foods they can consume. So with that, I'll conclude, and thank you very much for your time. Yes.
Normally, I just did the TTG IGA. Would you recommend
No, you know, I mean, so the question was about endomesial being more expensive. Certainly, I think whichever one is most accessible to you, I think the TTG is just as good. The endomesial IGA is good. And the gliadins are good if they're the deaminated gliadins. And so I think any of them are fine. I would avoid using multiple because then it may give you a false positive. Yes?
Does an endoscopy at 50 years of age rule out the possibility of celiac for the rest of their life?
So the question is, if doing an upper endoscopy when they're 50, like maybe the same time as they're screening colon, rule it out. It doesn't. Most people will not develop celiac disease that late in life, but we are seeing with a lot of these autoimmune diseases a second peak. We used to say the same thing with Crohn's disease, that if you don't have it by 40 or 50, you're not going to get it. We have people developing this at the age of 50 or 60. It's uncommon. So I would say that it's unlike. So if you did an endoscopy, then it would be unlikely if they had a normal small bowel that they would develop celiac disease later in life, but it wouldn't exclude it, and it wouldn't be sufficiently helpful to recommend that as a routine screening test at the age of 50 in the absence of symptoms. And with symptoms for sure, but I wouldn't do it without, because it wouldn't exclude it. Although, just purely by epidemiology, it'd be very unlikely whether or not you did the endoscopy at all. Okay, thank you very much.